here and I'm enjoying it quite a bit, and I should thank the Institute for inviting me, and in particular Florian. When the first invitation came, I was a little bit worried about the snow in this place. I don't function very well with snow, and he specifically arranged heat wave conditions for me, making me feel entirely at home. Thank you so much. So the today's topic, as he said, is about a new perspective on gravity. And in this seminar, which is quantum gravity, I don't have to tell you that all of us have a secret ambition to quantize gravity. And in case you thought that is not correct, a recent news report would set you right. I read that the Hollywood actress is learning string theory. Hopefully, she will come to loop quantum gravity soon. And worries about space and time, its existence, and stuff like that. Okay. So whoever thought these topics are not gathering attention, they definitely are. Okay. And but in spite of so many people spending time doing this, it's probably fair to say that there are still a lot of unresolved issues. So one possible way of looking at it, and which is what I'm going to do today, is to stare very hard at classical gravity with a little bit of knowledge of what we know about quantum field theory and ask whether it itself can reveal to us some interesting aspects. So you should concentrate on areas where there are possible contact and conflict between principles of quantum theory and gravity. And if you ask people what are these areas, the list will be highly personal. But roughly, people would say these sort of stuff. For example, the possible role of gravity as a UV regulatory. One, the singularity in cosmology or black hole collapse. How would one resolve this in a quantum gravitational matter? And this perennial problem of cosmological constant and whether it has anything to do with quantum gravity. And the thermodynamics of the horizons, where these, which can certainly be thought of as a point of contact and conflict. And today's talk is going to almost exclusively concentrate on the last item here. And what I wanted to sort of convince you, or try to make a case for, is that there is an alternate way of looking at this. The conventional view is that you start by looking at gravity as a fundamental interaction, and you derive the space-time thermodynamics from it. What I want to claim is that maybe it is better to look at it this way. You start from some kind of a space-time thermodynamics picture, and derive gravity as an emergent phenomenon. So this is the major shift in the point of view. So very roughly, somewhat with a poetic license, you think of gravity as some thermodynamic limit of an underlying theory of the statistical mechanics of atoms of space-time. So this is the perspective which I want to present. Now the somewhat more detailed plan of the talk is as follows. I want to first spend a little bit of time talking about the conventional approach to gravity and horizon thermodynamics. This is mainly intended for students and people who don't actually work on this area and where these things connect up. I'll just present the background. Then I'm going to spend fair amount of time talking about this. This is important because I'm going to talk about a whole lot of phenomena in classical gravity, which seems to suggest that probably there is an alternate perspective. So these are open questions which I will raise and leave it there. Then I will try to talk about the concept of emergent phenomena briefly, and then talk about how this alternate perspective emerges. Even if you are not convinced of this part, my own views in this subject has been changing at the rate of fairly rapidly. So this may not be the ultimate answers to anything. But I think these questions are important. And it would be important to ask those questions and try to come up with that answer. So that is why I'm going to spend a fair amount of time discussing that. So here are some list of recent papers which you may want to look at for more details. So I'm not going to go into the technical details in this talk. So let us begin with a textbook description of gravity. There are several excellent books on gravity, and you might randomly pick one of them. And if you do that, you will find that the gravity is described along the following lines. You start with principle of equivalence, and then you start with general covariance. So far, so good. It is very well defined and well understood, and you can put in. And the all of kinematics of gravity follows from that. Then you want to write down the dynamical equations, for which you need an action functional for gravity. That part is not as clear as the other two, but typically, let us look at an action functional of this for the of this kind for this talk. So you have a gravitational sector which, let us say, depends on the curvature tensor and the metric. For simplicity, I am ignoring derivatives of the curvature tensor, and there is a matter part. So if you vary it and you choose some suitable boundary conditions, etc., you can convince yourself that you get a field equation which is somewhat like this. So this part, I mean, it is a notation is used in order to remind you of the connection with Einstein's theory, so to speak. So there is a RAB kind of a structure coming out of this and this, and then you have this half L dAB and then this derivative comes. Now, of course, it is obvious that this is going to introduce higher order terms in the derivatives of the metric in the field equations. And if you do not want that, the simplest choice would be to take this choice. Let me remind you that this PABCD has the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, and it is obtained by the variation of this with respect to RABC. So this class of theories is what is usually called the Lovelock theories. And they have this field equations. And a more general class of theories would be given by this. Now, in all these theories, any of these theories, many of these theories have been studied in literature, and there are horizons in the solutions, on-shell solutions of these theories has horizons to these field equations. So let us take a closer look at horizons, because this whole concept of thermodynamics and entropy, etc., came from horizons. So in a sort of suitable coordinate system, you have a time axis and space axis, and the horizon is somewhere here, which divides it into inside and outside. So this whole game started long back when John Wheeler asked this question, that if you have a cup of tea and you let it fall into the horizon, can one violate the second law of thermodynamics by hiding entropy behind the horizon? And the answer is supposed to be that no, because the horizons have their own entropy, and that goes up when you put this cup of tea into that. So later on, I mean, that way horizons had this dubious distinction of the objects for which entropy was attributed even before temperature was attributed, and a lot of people didn't believe it at that time, including Stephen Hawking. But it's his own investigations led to, by now, famous result, that the black holes have a temperature, and then you can attribute all the thermodynamic properties to these systems. But very soon it was discovered that this is not the only case. So in the case of a black hole spacetime, essentially if you think of an eternal black hole, this is the kind of structure you have. There is an observer who is sitting at rest at some point on the black hole, and he attributes a temperature which is proportional to the surface gravity of the black hole. But it was shown very quickly by Paul Davis and Andrew that the black hole horizons is nothing very special, that even if you have a Rindler horizon in the flat space-time, it will have a temperature. So if you look at it geometrically, the structure is very, very similar to this. So the accelerated observer in a flat space-time has a trajectory, the hyperbolic trajectory, which is very similar to this black hole structure, and you do get a temperature attributed to this. And in general, the connection between the temperatures and the horizon is very generic. And what essentially happens is that the temperature attributed is some acceleration, either the surface gravity or the acceleration of the observer, etc., upon 2 pi multiplied by h cross over c. So the reason I wrote it down explicitly is that you will find that almost all of my talk in a quantum gravity seminar is going to be about classical gravity. But I will be able to make statements about the quantum nature for which I need my H-cross. And the H-cross is always going to be smuggled in through the relationship between temperature and acceleration. Acceleration can come from gravity. Gravity will provide the G and C. It will nicely combine with this H-cross at everywhere. So hereafter, of course, we will set H-cross and C to 1, except when it is really needed. Now, this result is completely independent of the field equations of the gravity. If I give you a metric which has a particular structure, like the Rindler structure near a horizon, then you can attribute a temperature to that. Where that metric came from is irrelevant at this level. Now, for those of you who are not in this field, let me just give a very rapid overview as why the horizons have a temperature associated with them. Very roughly speaking, it comes from the fact, which condensed matter people can immediately understand, that a periodicity in the time coordinate behaves, makes the systems behave as though there is a finite temperature, which in turn has to do with the fact that the evolution operator and the e to the minus beta h in a path integral formulation or whatever has a very similar structure. So any space-time which exhibits periodicity in the imaginary time will have a temperature associated with it. So if you take the kind of structures I was trying to show you, the hyperbolic trajectory here, The coordinate system which one is using has a tau and an r equals constant. And the metric is the Rindler form, which is written here. And you can, the coordinate transformations between these two are exhibited in this form. Now, if I continue to the imaginary time from tau to tau e, which is the Euclidean time or the imaginary time, with these parameters, the x and t becomes the hyperbola which we had before, becomes a circuit, a non-compact curve becomes a compact curve, and it has a periodicity with g chi. So you, this is just a plain sheet of paper in polar coordinates. So whenever you have such a structure, whenever you have a near horizon geometry which is almost Rindler, then you can associate a temperature with it. What is more important, if you know the nature of the near horizon geometry, from that you can read out what the temperature is. And none of this, let me stress again, has anything to do with field equations of the theory from which the metric is coming. So this is fine, and this is all conventional stuff. You start from a theory for gravity, and then if you have an on-shell solution with a horizon, you can do the thermodynamics. You can do, for example, quantum field theory in that space-time and obtain the standard results the way Hawking did. So why am I saying that there should be an alternative perspective? What I'm going to spend, as I said, a block of time, is that I want to argue that the conventional approach has no explanation for several peculiar features and has to be treated as some kind of an algebraic accident in the case. And I believe that these peculiar features provide an internal evidence that we are looking at gravity the wrong way around. Okay? Now, this is an important message which I am trying to convey, so let me spend one moment on that. If you go back to the evolution of our ideas about general relativity in Einstein's time, we knew for a very long time that the inertial mass is equal to the gravitational mass. This is an internal evidence that gravity has a geometrical nature to it. And when you have the geometrical description of gravity, this result emerges in a very natural fashion. You don't try to model what is inertial mass, what is gravitational mass, equate those two and try to do what happens. I mean, we had Einstein so that he had his tremendous insight to say that this is the right way to do that. So in some sense, these internal evidences should be taken seriously, and that is what I'm going to spend time on. So what are these features? So let me start with a very simple one. And
yeah. Evidence, I guess, not an internal evidence.
Yeah. What is the distinction?
Well, experiment is outside theory. So
outside what? Oh, you mean you have a theory space and a. Okay. Let us not nitpick on that. So the first example, which I will take a very simple case to illustrate the point, is that think of any spherically symmetric space-time with a horizon at some point r is equal to a, and it has a surface gravity g, then you can attribute to it a temperature by that Rindler condition. So this is the only place where h-cross makes it appear. Now you go and look at the Einstein's equation for this space-time and just evaluate the Einstein's equation at r is equal to a on the horizon. This is, take any of your favorite textbook and you'll get this equation. Here, P is the pressure due to the external source, which is producing the metric, and everything else is well-defined. Okay, and if P is zero, you can put it to zero. Now, I want to write this equation a slightly different way. I'm going to multiply this equation by dA, and then the right-hand side immediately becomes P times d of this quantity. You can think of it as 4 pi a square, which is the proper area times a dA in a parameter, or you can write it like this. Now, this term just goes for a ride. It becomes like this. And in this term, I'm going to introduce a h-cross by hand, both on top and at the bottom, so as to read off this quantity from this. The pressure is the, this metric is produced by some source, and this is the pressure of the source, the radial pressure of that source. Like, for example, if you think of Reisner-Nostrand metric, then the TAB of the Reisner-Nostrand metric will provide pressure. It's just the source pressure. It is not a pure gravity, it is zero, of course. Yeah. Okay. Now, this you can immediately read off because there is a PdV there. Yeah, yeah. TRR. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is the temperature which you come up from this. This cries out for the following interpretation where you write these two terms. So, what is going on here? You can immediately read off from this. First, this Einstein's equation takes the shape of TdS minus dE is equal to PdV. And you can read off these two. And if you go and read this paper, it will tell you that there is no arbitrariness, you can't rescale things, and it is unique, there are numerical factors, etc., etc. But here is a purely classical result coming from the field equations of gravity. Combine it with the Andrew temperature formula, and you can get this result. Einstein's equation can be written as this. Now, you are not supposed to read through the whole of it. This is just to illustrate that after that work was done, it was followed up by several groups. And what they essentially showed is that there is a wide class of systems involving gravity in which field equations reduce to TdS equal to dE plus PdV on the horizon. Okay. So there are also issues like whether this is just the first law of the sort of laws of thermodynamics coming in disguise, etc. And you can argue they are not the same. So I won't go into that. But there's a whole lot of pieces of work, including Rowe Lipschitz gravity, okay, which does not have the kind of symmetries we usually associate with things. In all of them, these equations reduce to this form. Now, the question is why? We don't know. Now, let me ask a second question. Now, assume for a minute that there is an alternate description for the entire dynamics. Already, I'm saying that the dynamical equations can be given a thermodynamical interpretation. If that is the case, of course, we can also derive the dynamical equation from the action principle itself by the standard textbook procedure. Shouldn't the action principle contain a hint that an alternative prescription is available? Because after all, the field equations know that. Now, it does, and I'm going to describe that next. Yes?
Does it work for vacuum scenarios?
It does work for vacuum scenarios. It just becomes TdS equal to dE, that's all. Of course it works.
Well,
you put P is equal to zero, that's all. And that's fine. Okay, so it does work in all the action functionals. There is something very peculiar which gives you this hint. And let me try to describe that next. Now, what happens, for the lack of a better term, I'm going to call it holographic, and it doesn't have anything directly to do with the standard string theoretic holographic. I'll define what I mean by that. If you look at classical mechanics 101, we know that if you have a Lagrangian with a Q and Q dot, and you vary this, you will get a field equation if you keep delta Q fixed at the end points. But what is not often emphasized in the classical mechanics text, at least in the Lagrangian formulation, is that it is possible to write down another Lagrangian which uses not only Q and Q dot, but also has Q double dot. But when you vary it, your equations of motion don't become third derivative. It still gets exactly the same equations you get from here. All that you have to do is to define this LP to be this LQ minus d by dt of this. It's very obvious if you think in terms of canonical transformations. So this has a QP structure. And then when you vary, you keep delta P fixed at the endpoints, and in that momentum representation, it gives you exactly the same field equations as this. So you can write down a very special class of Lagrangians which involves second derivatives of the dynamical variables, but the field equations will still be second order in the dynamical variables. That is good. We do know one such system, which is gravity, and is gravity of that kind. And lo and behold, it is. If you just take r root minus g, everyone knew that it can be separated into a bulk term, which is the gamma-gamma term, and a surface term, which is the derivatives of the gammas. But what is interesting is that there is exactly this relationship between the surface term and the bulk term. Think of this as some kind of a total derivative term, and this is your Q, and this is your P. Okay. So the surface term, which was always either ignored or sort of you add a counter term and cancel it out, is related to the bulk term in a very specific kind of manner. So this is what I call the holographic redundancy, in some sense, that the surface and the bulk talk to each other, and there is a very specific structure which is connected between these two. Now, this is a bit non-trivial because of the fact that the surface term in the action on shell gives you the horizon entropy. Now, let me try to stress it in a slightly dramatic fashion. You start with the gravitational action again. You have a bulk term and a surface term. You either cancel surface term, or first, more simply, let us just ignore the surface term and let us take the gamma square action. You vary it, you get the field equations. You have the field equations, and the field equations has a solution with a horizon. Then you do a quantum field theory in this curved spacetime, you obtain some entropy for this horizon. The surface time was thrown just after equation 1 in your paper. The system doesn't know anything about the surface time. After doing all this, you go and calculate that surface term which you threw, evaluate it on the horizon, and you will get the entropy of that horizon, one quarter of the area in Einstein's theory. So how does the surface term know that there is something like this going on? And you can show that this has to do with that holographic relationship between these two. And in fact, it is possible to come up with a completely different alternate formulation of classical gravity using just the surface term, but I won't go into that. This is interesting, but there are this gets better. I mean, there are other connections between gravitational dynamics and the space-time thermodynamics once you bring in the action functional and look at the surface and the bulk time. For example, these things work very well for static space-time. There is no natural generalization to non-static space-time. If you take any static space-time with a horizon, you can write down the action having a bulk term and a surface term as some kind of a free energy of the space-time. More interestingly, you can take the Einstein's equation and from that obtain a relation. Take a static space-time, write down Einstein's equation, it can be rewritten in this form. This is the energy which is acting as the source, the Komar mass of the space-time. It can be written in a very suggestive form as half k n t. Now, since the temperature can depend on space, it is like an integral over dn. Where this T, the temperature here is just the acceleration temperature of observers who is sitting at this n is equal to constant surface, the static observers. And there is this dn which you can read off from this relation. And that happens to be just area divided by Lp square. Again, in order to get Lp square, I need a h cross. And h cross is provided by the conversion between this temperature and this acceleration. The g and c comes from the gravity. So you can think of any of these surfaces as bits with area Lp square divided up. And this E is equal to half nkt. Of course, this half is just window decoration because I can rescale n and remove that half. But it is just written in a suggestive form. I'll say more about this later on. And it is also possible to interpret in these spacetimes the field equations itself as some kind of a loss of matter entropy through the flow of matter across the horizon. This is all fine, and you might have thought when I first mentioned this that this is all some very peculiar features of Einstein's theory of gravity. And in fact, this is one place where my approach differs from that of many other people, including Fred Jacobson and others. I don't think Einstein gravity is anything special. All these things are essentially encoded only in principle of equivalence and general covariance. And it turns out that virtually any of these results which we have obtained can be extended for a much wider class of theories, in particular to the Lovelock models. For example, temperature and entropy can be defined in any generally covariant theory of gravity. You have a definition of Wald entropy for these systems. The field equations do become TdS equal dE plus pdV on the horizon for a wide class of models. That I gave you a host of references, and that has been now well established. More surprisingly, the Lovelock Lagrangian also has the same kind of holographic redundancy I talked about. You can separate the Lovelock Lagrangian in a very natural fashion into a surface term and a bulk term. And what is more, the surface term is given by that d by qp kind of a structure of the bulk term. Yes?
This work by Jenny Trashen and collaborators who say that instead of energy, you should put, if you want to replace energy by mass, then you should interpret it as enthalpy, not energy.
Yeah. So that works in a very specific cases, while this is much more general.
Okay, but you say, when you say energy, do you mean mass? Or
I mean the Komar mass. That's a very specific definition of that in Lovelock theory.
Okay.
Field equations are a system of 10 equations, and TdS is d plus pdV is 1. So
that's
what about
right.
The other 9?
I'll get back to that. Okay. But in this particular context of spherically symmetric case which I described, there is only one non-trivial equation. But in general, the way it comes out is that you take local Rundler horizon at every place, and you say that for all of them, this has to hold.
In fact, Einstein's equation itself can be thought of as something like GAB UA UB is equal to rho, where the GAB UA AB can be interpreted as the projection of the spatial curvature. So it has to work for every observer is what contains the information. Now, I told you that in the Lovelock theories, you can separate them into a holographic form, into a surface term and a bulk term. The surface term, again, gives you the entropy of the horizon. And the on-shell action becomes the free energy in static space-time. And this is partially in response to your question that enthalpy interpretation doesn't work in the Lovelock theories, but it works in these cases, at least as far as I know. Finally, the equipartition law, so to speak, which I talked to you about, that the energy is some half k n d t, works for all Lovelock models. Only thing which changes is how many bits per unit area you give. If you take a proper area root sigma times a two-dimensional or d minus two-dimensional four-dimensional two surface, and the number of bits you associated with it is given by this object. This p a b c d is the d l by d r a b c. So all those theories can be characterized by this PABCD. In turn, if you, from a microscopic theory, you just tell me what is this delta N, then I know my theory. So for a wide class of theories, this entire approach works. And the question is why? It's not very clear to me. Now at this stage, all this is very clean and very rigorously provable mathematics. I just want to take a little bit of an aside and mention one more peculiar feature of gravity. I'm not going to elaborate on this during this talk because it's a completely separate issue by itself, which has to do with the fact that gravity seems to be immune to the ground state energy. And since there are cosmologists in the audience, let me just make some comments about that. We do know that the cosmological constant term in Einstein's equation acts like a matter with negative pressure, and it is consistent with all the dark energy observations. And it has a very bad press, the cosmological constant. But the real problem with cosmological constant is that gravity seems to be completely immune to vacuum energy. What do I mean by that? Suppose you take the matter sector of the theory and forget supersymmetry for a moment, then the Lagrangian in the matter sector can be shifted by a constant. And the field equations of the matter sector will not know that because it only involves derivatives of the Lagrangian. However, the gravity is not invariant under this transformation, and it picks up, the TAB picks up a rho times GAB. And the gravity sector, therefore, breaks the asymmetry, which is present in the matter sector, so to speak. So if you solve the cosmological constant problem in some way without addressing this issue, and somebody just changes the matter sector Lagrangian by a constant, so to speak, then you are in trouble again because a new constant has come. So one way of looking at this problem is that if you genuinely want to solve the cosmological constant problem and get it to zero, not to this value which we are measuring as dark energy, get it to zero, then you need a theory in which the gravitational sector is invariant under TAB going to TAB plus rho GA. Such a theory will be nice in the sense that it will give you zero cosmological constant. Of course, the problem remains as to how do you then account for your dark energy by a small amount of cosmological constant. I have some thoughts on that, which is the part which I will not go into. But this approach will make the gravity completely immune to a Lorentz invariant vacuum energy density. Well, it can be stated in the form of a very simple theorem. If you have a theory in which metric is a dynamical variable and is varied in the action, and the action is generally covariant and local as an integral over a Lagrangian, and the equations of motion for the matter sector is invariant under this, that is to exclude things like supersymmetric theories, then the cosmological constant problem cannot be solved the way I have stated it. That is, the gravitational equation cannot be invariant under this. It's fairly obvious. It is not a deep theorem. In the sense that it essentially comes because there is a root minus g factor whose variation will give you a contribution. So one of these three has to be violated if you want to get out of it. And we will see in the thermodynamic perspective of gravity, one of them naturally gets violated. Okay, so here is the summary of what I have been saying so far. Okay, maybe I'll take your question.
Condition means how could the matter equations fail to be invariant?
Sorry, equations of
this is you've just added a constant which doesn't involve any of the matter.
Absolutely. No. Well, I mean, there are, for example, if you take supersymmetric Lagrangian, then this, so if supersymmetry is an exact symmetry, then you cannot add a constant to the Lagrangian.
Okay? So I'm just saying that it, just to make it very clear, I state it as an explicit example. That's all. Okay. Yeah.
No. Presumably the equations of motion will be the same.
That is not the point. You are not allowed to add a constant to the Hamiltonian. In supersymmetric theories, do have a natural zero for the constant.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So that, I mean, if you think it is correct and I don't have to state it, I'll just cut it off. Okay, you are just strengthening my conclusion.
Yes.
Yes, so you're going to come back to this. Are you going to argue then for unimodular gravity, or are you going to argue for unimodular gravity coming from thermodynamics?
Well, it is not unimodular gravity. It is something slightly different, but it has a similar structure. I'll tell you what it is coming from. Yeah. It's very closely related to unimodular gravity, but it doesn't have the problems of unimodular gravity. Okay. Right. So here is the
questions which you should be worrying about if you don't believe the rest of my talk. Okay? So you need to come up with independent answers to that. The first is, why do Einstein's equations reduce the thermodynamic identity for some virtual displacement of the horizon? Why is Einstein-Hilbert action holographic in the sense that the surface and the bulk term has this very peculiar feature? And why is it that the surface term is not something added extra, but it gives you the horizon entropy on shell? And why is it that the microscopic degrees of freedom in loosely defined sense as area divided by some LP square or whatever obey the thermodynamic equipartition in static spacetime? And why is gravity immune to the bulk vacuum energy? And most importantly, why does it work for a much, much wider class of theories than just GR? So there is nothing very special about GR, and it must be coming from something very deep and fundamental and has nothing to do with the field equations. Yes.
I think I understand the argument you're making until you get to the last point. That is. So there is something special about general relativity out of all its competitors, which have these properties, which is that it's confirmed experimentally.
Right. So that is why I discuss all this for that. Then I show that the entire Lovelock family of things has these.
So if you're making an argument that there's something deeper than general relativity,
mm-hmm.
which these all hint to, it's completely irrelevant that there may be some theory other than general relativity which is not experimentally validated, which has these properties. What's important is that the theory which is experimentally validated has these properties.
No, that's fine. But I don't contradict that. What I'm trying to say is that in general relativity, you have three ingredients. Principal equivalence, general covariance, and the action functional of the dynamical equations. I think of them as independent in some loose sense of the word.
Yes.
Now, what I will show is that theories which obey the principle of equivalence and general covariance, okay, will have this property. And if the dynamical equations are of second order, then that naturally leads to the Lovelock theories. Now, in some sense, this argument becomes academic, because if you believe that your space-time dimension is 4, then I will uniquely get Einstein's theory out of this, because the Lovelock at d is equal to 4 reduces to Einstein. But if you believe that the space-time has d greater than 4, then there are wider possibilities which are available. So I do not want to exclude them by hand at this stage. Purely mathematically, if I take Lovelock theory in d dimension, all these statements happen to be true. Whether it tells you something deeper, or whether I have to add additional constraints to eliminate them, that's the point of view. Okay. Fine. So here is where I want to suggest the possibility that this is happening because gravity is an emergent phenomenon and it is not the way we should be thinking about, and we should look at it in a completely different way.
So what do I mean by that? Well, this idea has been around for a very long time, and I would like to call it Sakharov paradigm, because I believe he's the first one to state it so clearly. So it can be stated in the form of some kind of an analogy. So you have, let's take a solids or gas or liquid or whatever. So it has this macroscopic property. There is mechanics, there is elasticity, etc. So you use suitable variables for that, like density or the elasticity of this material or things of that kind. In the same sort of way, the space-time is analogous to this, and you have Einstein's theory which describes at this level, and you use some collective or coarse-grained variables like metric, curvature, etc. They have the same kind of significance as these statements. Underlying it, there is a statistical mechanics of atoms and molecules, which fortunately we know. I mean, we understand that, and we do. And we conjecture that something similar should exist here, which unfortunately we don't know, we don't have any clue of. But the key point is that there is an in-between layer here, which links these two. And just as Boltzmann could infer the existence of microscopic degrees of freedom in a gas just by knowing the fact that gas can hold up heat, by knowing some properties of this, we may be able to guess this thermodynamics of this equation. So my approach is going to be decidedly top-down rather than bottom-up, which is what quantum gravity guys should be doing. So this is what I'm going to think of as some kind of an emergent phenomena and a description. So let me just try to illustrate that in this case of this equipartition, just as one example out of this many of these things. So the space-times can be heated up just like gas can be heated up. So if I take a glass of water and I run with it, that water will get heated because there is an untrue temperature in the accelerated frame, and that temperature will interact with these degrees of freedom and will heat it up. Or if I have a glass of water here and I collapse a black hole out there, the Hawking radiation from that can heat this up. So space-times can be heated up. And if you look at the boundaries of this, at n is equal to constant boundaries of these static space-times, I told you that something like an equipartition law holds here. So how do you think of it? Let me try to give it to you in a sort of figurative way. So here is a spherical body with a radius r is equal to 6m. And there is someone who is sitting here, and he sees zero temperature at this stage. Now you go and collapse this black hole, and the moment collapse that body to make a black hole, and then you will end up getting a temperature which is related to the surface gravity in this case. Now you can think of this entire space-time to have been heated up by this process. And what is more, if you now take this surface and you write down the explicit expression for that, here I have again reintroduced H cross and C, and you attribute to each of these degrees of freedom, which is area upon LP square, and you go and compute half n kT by just plugging in these things, you get E equals mc square. So this entire concept, of, at least in spherically symmetric cases, is very easy, and the more general thing was what I have shown you here. So this relationship in a spherically symmetric case just reduces to that. And as I told you, it goes further, and even for Lovelock theories, you can play this sort of game. So there is a concept by which this equipartition do come in. And this I want to connect up between a gaseous system or a fluid system and a space-time by making a comparative analogy. So what Boltzmann essentially said, or the Boltzmann postulate, is that if you can heat up something, it should have substructure. Where does that come from? If you think of the conventional description of a gas dynamic, go back a few centuries before Boltzmann, you know nothing about atomic or molecular structure of matter. But you do know that there are heat engines operating, and there is exchange of energy between hot bodies and cold bodies, and there is something called heat. When you are trying to do that, at those days, you needed two kinds of variables. One is the purely mechanical variables, like the velocity or even pressure, which can be interpreted in terms of force. And then there are thermodynamical variables, which are entropy, heat content, free energy, etc. Engineers could use this without ever knowing what they were. The Boltzmann's insight lies in connecting these two up. And he said that the thermodynamical variables are nothing but mechanical variables of certain underlying degrees of freedom. And in my mind, the simplest expression of that is in this relation. In this relation, energy and the temperature are completely thermodynamical variables. They don't care about statement. But this N is a purely statistical mechanical variable. It counts the number of microscopic degrees of freedom. So you have two objects, E and G, and it is related by the, in some sense, it is like the Avogadro's number, which tells you how many microstructure, how many degrees of freedom are contributing to this.
For black holes, observing a thermal ensemble or a temperature is an characteristic of certain class of observers.
Yeah.
So how does this enter, how does the rule of observer?
Photon per center is going to come on. In fact, the rule of observer is going to be very overwhelming as it goes along.
Okay,
I'll come back to that. It's a good point. Now, once you have this, in principle, all thermodynamic laws should be derivable from the
microscopic laws of pi to the microscopic degrees of freedom. But remember that that is not the way historically we proceed. Most of the time, you just come up with a symmetry principle or a conjecture and come up with some kind of a form of the thermodynamic potential. I mean, if you read Landau Volume 7 on elasticity, he will try to describe any solid by starting with some thermodynamic potential in terms of the displacement field when the system is distorted. Once you have that, you can have a phenomenological description of the system. Remember that I'm going to do top-down rather than bottom-up, so I'm not afraid of phenomenology. And this procedure has the advantage that it is very general, it is very powerful, and is completely devoid of specifics, which I think is an advantage. And in fact, if you think about it, you never took a course in quantum thermodynamics, and for a very important reason. You did quantum mechanics, quantum electrodynamics, quantum statistical mechanics, never did quantum thermodynamics. The thermodynamics is already quantum. All that you needed to do was to change the expressions for entropy or the thermodynamic potentials in a relativistically invariant way or in a quantum mechanical way, and then when you write down the thermodynamical laws, it takes care of everything. So it has a remarkable stability, and that is something which we can put to good use. So all this was for heating up the gas, but you can also heat up the space-time. So then the Boltzmann postulate says that if you can heat it up, it must have substructure. So you start by saying that you should study the space-time just as we studied gas dynamics before we understood atomic structure of matter. So let us do a top-down study of space-time. So the thermodynamic description should be quite useful, and it should be independent of the exact nature of microscopic degrees of freedom. Whether it is string theory, whether it is loop quantum gravity, whether it's some dynamical triangulation, or whatever is your quantum gravity model. As long as it satisfies Andrew kind of an effect or the Andrew temperature kind of results in one end, and the classical Einstein's gravity at another end, some of the results should be available there. And the exact nature of quantum gravity description should be irrelevant at this level.
Prediction, there was an
aim. Yes.
It was a prediction of the matter.
Absolutely.
That has to come from.
I will give you that prediction. In fact, I have already given that formula. I can tell you the Avogadro number of the space time. And that has to come from a microscopic theory.
Yeah, so
it's
a test
on the microscope. There is a test on the microscopic theory. That will distinguish, for example, between Einstein's theory and the Lovelock theory. Okay, that PA is really has to come from the microscopic theory. You are ahead of me by two transparencies. Okay. Right. Now, of course, again, you can describe most of the systems. Like if you study the ideal gas equation for helium gas
or argon gas, it doesn't depend on the details. A few numbers will take care of that. So things like metric curvature, etc., has a similar role to play. And then we come to the concept of entropy. In the case of a gaseous system or a fluid mechanics, you just choose certain degrees of freedom as degrees of freedom you want to latch on. Other degrees of freedom you coarse grain or integrate out. But in the case of space-time, there are unobservable degrees to a given observer, and that is what comes in. So let us try to focus on this. This is also related to the first question Sumita asked. So if you have some thermodynamic potential, S of QA, where the, let us say, the entropy or free energy or whatever, in terms of some suitably defined variables for the observers, then you can try to construct the theory out of that, which I will show how to do that. However, the moment you do that, the entire behavior is the thermodynamic potentials, for example, is going to depend on the class of observers which you choose. But the field equations will not. I will show you how that comes about. Now, this is very important because one of the messages which I hope to, if I get time in the end, to stress is that I don't think we understand normal entropy of a hot cup of coffee as well as we should. We believe that this is an observer-independent quantity. It is logarithm of the microstates of the system. But you just take that cup of coffee and run. Then the temperature of the cup of coffee, which you will have thought of as the real temperature, quote-unquote, will get entangled with the Andrew temperature in the accelerated frame. If you take excited states above the vacuum and look at it in the Rindler prime, you can show this thing very explicitly. And the entropy of any thermodynamic system has an observer dependency. Yeah?
What about the static observers?
No, this statement is more general. But the static observer things are much, much, much simpler.
But in the thermodynamics, you usually define it for a static.
That's correct. That's correct. So it is much simpler to handle static observers. That is what I'm going to concentrate on. But the observer dependence of the entropy, I think, is a very general construct, and you can't escape from it.
But static, you make inertia also.
But no. Not inertia, but static. In the sense that if you take a Rindler observer or a short sail observer who is sitting quietly at the margin, the background metric has a fine-like killing vector.
But those are accelerated compared.
That's correct. That is fine. You know, static in the sense of time-like killing metric. Yeah. Okay. So this I have already mentioned. And so what we need is a phenomenological entropy function for the space-time entropy,
and you maximize it, and you should be able to get field equation. Where does that come from? So let me try to explain that approach. You start from principle of equivalence, and the gravity is described at the Coarse-Kane scale by some kind of a metric. Now you go around any event, and there, not only there are local inertial observers, by boosting, you can get Rindler observers with a local horizon. And in fact, this was the seminal contribution of Ted Jacobson, that the local Rindler observer has a important role to play. So this is how it comes about. You take some event. These are some null rays going through the event, and there is some observer which is defined here in such a way that when you go to the Riemann normal coordinates here, these things become 45-degree lines, and the local Rindler observer has a hyperbolic trajectory. And this whole thing is valid in some radius, which is decided by the background curvature. By taking a sufficiently large acceleration, you can keep it well within this. So you can do these sort of local structures, and this is much easier to understand in the Euclidean continuation analog. There is a circle on which the Rindler observer is going round and round, and there is a region around which this local approximation is valid because there is a curvature scale beyond which you cannot do. So you introduce this, and then you ask, can the flow of matter across this local horizon hide entropy? And this you twist a little bit. You say that instead of pouring Wheeler's T across the horizon, suppose I just displace the horizon to cover the T. So if I make a virtual displacement of the horizon, it should cost me some amount of entropy. It is equivalent to pouring the T across. So you want to write down an entropy functional in terms of virtual displacement vectors of the normals to the null surfaces of the local horizon. And then by maximizing the entropy of the matter plus this, you want to obtain the field equation. Conceptually, I like it very much because it essentially tells you that use local inertial frames and assume laws of special relativity are valid, and you get the kinematics of gravity. Then you use local Rindler frames, and you assume that the laws of thermodynamics should hold, and you get the dynamics of gravity. So that is what you need to do. So I'll give you a new variational principle. Let me just write it down. So you consider a functional, which involves a vector field psi A, and you introduce this P A B C D and a T A B psi A psi B, and then you can argue that if this delta S is equal to zero, for every observer, and this is coming back to your question that how can one thing give you 10 equations, you demand that it should hold for every Rindler observer who is crawling around in this arbitrary space-time. And it should constrain the background, and it should lead to up to second-order field equations. If you put these two demands, it turns out that this PABCD has a unique structure which is related to the Lovelock's PABCD by this form. So you take any Lankos Lovelock Lagrangian, and you take this PABCD and then construct this functional. And if you maximize this, it leads to the dynamics. And this leads exactly to the Lovelock theory, but with an arbitrary integration constant which comes in as a cosmological constant. Just to illustrate this, let me take the simplest of the Lovelock theories, the Einstein theory. So how do I get GR out of it? When you do that, the equation which you finally get is this. This is coming back to Lee's question about relation with unimodular gravity. What the theory tells you is not quite Einstein's theory. It tells you GAB minus kappa TAB times IA IB should be 0 for all null vectors psi A. Which means that if I add to TAB anything which is proportional to GAB, that doesn't hold. But because BNG identity has to be satisfied, exactly as in the unimodular theory, you find that the trace-free part is obtained and the other part gives you an arbitrary cosmological constant. So this is, of course, unique in D is equal to 4, and then there is a new symmetry because of this. Yeah, I think I'm running a little bit out of time. I will skip this. Yeah, okay. So let me just make this comment. It turns out, in this, I made a comment that I would like to have second-order differential equation for the field equation. It is not necessary. This is the most general case. If you start with this action, and you vary it and you play the same game, then you get the full Einstein's, full field equations involving the derivatives of the PABCD. So this is the precise statement which you should carry home with. You give me a Lagrangian, which depends on a curvature tensor and metric, which leads to this field equation, in which you are varying the metric to get the field equation. Then I will give you another functional, which is this, depending on a vector field. And if you vary this vector field and you demand that the variation should be zero for all such vector fields, then it will lead to exactly the same equation. That is just mathematics. But the physics of this is that this is interpreted as the total entropy of the Rindler observers crawling around all over the place. Yes?
Easier to go back to the...
Previous one. Let me just give you that.
So
you write down the most general quadratic in the derivatives and in this.
No. But I just want to understand what this theory is a function of. So C are vector fields. D is some covariant derivative.
Mm-hmm.
And P is what?
It's some function of the curvature tensor and the metric, which is defined by this.
So this theory has in it a metric, it has a curvature, and so forth.
Yeah. So this is not a theory in the sense that it is going to constrain you. It is a peculiar thing. It is going to constrain the background when you demand that the variation has to be zero for all these vector fields. Now, that looks very strange. Normally, when you vary something, you say that I should get the field equation for what I vary, for the dynamical variable. That is not what is happening here. That is why you should go back and ask how we obtain the kinematics of gravity.
Right, so what I don't understand. So there is a metric as the curvature. This is a second order form. The curvature
Absolutely.
Is a function of the metric.
Right.
And the claim is that just by varying the C's,
right.
you get four equations.
Yes.
And those four equations are equivalent to the 10 equations of the Einstein
Absolutely.
Equations.
Because you are demanding it should hold for every Z. That's right. Okay, so let me go further.
You have a boundary term in C.
Very interestingly, that is an advantageous part of this issue. If you want to derive Lovelock theory, then there is a horrible boundary term which you have to cancel out. But if you do psi, there is no boundary term in psi. And if you wait for a few minutes, the boundary term which comes out after around the on-shell level of the theory will have a physical interpretation. Let me just describe that, and we will get back to this. Okay, so this is the more general class of models.
Yeah, okay. This is directly related to what you were saying. I wrote down a functional, but then I said that, this is the entropy of this space-time. But where is entropy? What is the entropy going on here? It's just I could have called it an action functional. Why did I call it an entropy? That has to come from this fact. At the end, after you have written down the field equations for this general theory, I can go back and calculate the extremum value of this action functional. You find a result which is very interesting, that the total, think of that as an entropy. I'm going to justify it. That action functional's value in some region V resides only on its boundary. Okay? And the boundary value on shell turns out to be precisely equal to the walled entropy. Now, this is something which I want to stress. This was not put in by hand. You write down the most general quadratic functional. Then you demanded that when I vary the null vectors, that is, I think of them physically as random fluctuations of the null surfaces as perceived by every Rindler observer. And I say that the entropy has to be maximized with respect to every Rindler observer's local thermodynamics. Then I get a field equation. I plug this field equation back into the action, and I find what it is. In the back of the mind, I think of that as an entropy. And there's a consistency check that this entropy should match with what we normally think of as the entropy of a horizon, which is the world entropy. And it matches precisely. And there was no fudge factors with freedom to use this. So this, I think, is a non-trivial consistency check on that. Now, it turns out that in the semi-classical limit, you can also argue that this action functional should have a value 2 pi n. To the lowest order, it leads to area quantization. You still have a question. Right.
Is to a space-time volume.
Yes.
Whereas the entropy of a horizon that we normally think of corresponds to a cross-section of the horizon.
Right.
So now what volume do you have in mind when you say it matches the standard entropy of the horizon?
If in the case of an on-shell solution which has a horizon, if you take the standard cross-section which you would have taken, it matches with the world entropy.
But what over what volume are you computing? Initial and final boundary?
No. You just think of a timeline, what you call the stressed horizon, and then you take the limit of that stressed horizon going to the real horizon.
Yes, but over what? Suppose you have structural time, over what amount of structural time?
So how do we compute the world entropy for a short sail-like solution in Lovelock theory?
No, but I'm asking about your expression.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that whatever we do there, you do exactly the same thing here. Then you get the identical result. But it is not guaranteed that it should give you the identical result. I'm probably missing the point. We can discuss it later. Yeah. Okay. Well, I will skip this as well.
You are right. I mean, it is exceeding the time, but I'll take some few more minutes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, so this is almost the basic point which I have made, and I will try to put this in a conceptual framework so that the mathematics gets embedded in that. So let me try to do it through a series of flow diagrams. What do I have in this approach? I start with principle of equivalence. Then I interpret principle of equivalence in some very broad sense as implying three things. First, it tells you that gravity can be described as a geometric structure. It tells you that the light cone structure is affected by gravity because at every local inertial frame, the gravity is affecting the light rays and light rays are bending, and that gives you this result. It also tells you that there is some kind of a democracy of observers because the acceleration, local accelerations cannot be distinguished from gravity. How much of the metric is due to acceleration and how much of the metric is due to gravity is not a well-defined question. Then I go from here to argue that because there is a light cone structure is affected by gravity, you have observers who will have horizons blocking information. And the blocking of information leads to attributing entropy to all horizons. Once I have done that, I go back to this, and then I notice that the democracy of observers can also be thought of in terms of diffeomorphism invariance, or what we usually call general covariance, which leads to another current. And from this another current, combining with this horizon having an entropy, I can write down an expression for the space-time entropy density. In fact, the expression which I wrote down, I didn't interpret it that way because I didn't develop the formalism of another current. It is essentially the another charge density integrated over a volume. So you have an entropy density. Then you just maximize this entropy density for all observers. And this principle leads you to the field equations. So this is the thermodynamic or the emergent perspective to the gravity. So central to this is that there is a space-time has an entropy density, and I have to write down an expression for the entropy density. If I say that the entropy density is quadratic in the displacement field, you think of general coordinate transformation now like elastic deformations of the space-time solid, so to speak, and it is quadratic in this, then it leads to the Lovelock field equation. If you have terms which are more general, then you can get a more generic space time. So this entire structure stands by itself. Then it has this peculiar feature that it leads to this equipartition of energy, which is coming back to what Sumit was pointing out, that That has a specific expression. I can give you what is delta n per unit area of the surfaces. What I want is a microstructure of the space-time, a microscopic theory, to give me this and give me this, and why the entropy is quadratic if it is quadratic. And that is going to act as a test of the theory. What the microscopic structure of the theory is going to give for this delta n is going to act as a test of the theory. So what are the open questions? There are quite a few. First thing is, why does all this work? One interpretation is what I have been trying to push, that gravity is an emergent phenomenon. So assume for a minute I'm completely wrong. Gravity is not an emergent phenomena. It is a standard thing. You have gravity and you have to quantize gravity in some way. There is quantum field theory in curved space-time. It gives you thermodynamics, etc., etc. Then you need to be disturbed a little bit that this alternate formalism exists. It has a life of its own and it seems to work. And it is telling you something and you have to understand what it is telling you. And I have not been able to find out any other interpretation which fits all the facts. Now, what are these atoms of space-time? And what is the statmec behind the thermodynamics? Here I am in a very difficult position. What was our strength becomes a weakness now. The thermodynamics is so robust because it is completely independent of the microscopic details. So you can come up with any theory, and as long as the theory has the correct classical limit in the sense of it produces Einstein's theory or Lovelock theory in some limit, and it is consistent with the Andrew acceleration temperature result, then everything which I have said will go through. So that still leaves you with a very wide class of theory. It is really difficult to use this and then guess at what kind of microscopic theories we are talking about. We are now talking about knowing thermodynamics, derived Schrodinger equation for hydrogen atom or something like that. I mean, that simply cannot be done. So I'm not sure it will work. There is also this question as to why is it that the microscopic degrees of freedom at Planck scale is playing a role near the horizon and null surfaces. I have some loose thoughts on that. It has to do with this fact that these coordinate-dependent infinite redshift surfaces in some sense is probing Trans-Planckian effects. But I won't push into that. But it is an interesting question to keep in mind. Again, coming back to one of the questions which came up earlier on, a very new level of observer dependence into the thermodynamic variables has been brought in by that. I had to explicitly say that there is a whole class of Rindler observers, and each of them is maximizing their entropy functionals, and that is what leads to the field equations into the theory. And there are broader implications for that, which maybe tomorrow or sometime I can talk to people who are interested. Much of these has an interesting mathematical structure in the sense that the horizons, local horizons particularly, comes up in a way which is very analogous to the defects in solids in condensed matter physics. And that can be used for a new path integral prescription to go further than this in this theory, but this is again an open question right now. So can you do better than the host of all other quantum gravity models? Canon says something non-trivial about cosmological constant problem or singularity problem, etc. These are good things to think in these lines, but I don't have clear answers. So the summary, I will just put it up there. Yeah. So the first point is that there is internal evidence, or according to external evidence, to suggest that the dynamics of gravity is like the thermodynamic description of macroscopic body. I hope I have convinced you of that. Conceptually, local Rindler observers around every event attribute some amount of entropy to the local null surface, and the observer-dependent entropy density to the space-time emerges out of it. And you use principle of equivalence and local inertial primes to determine the kinematics, and these Rindler primes and the local thermodynamics to determine the dynamics of the gravity. This entropy density, if you maximize for all the null surfaces together, then you end up getting the field equations of the theory. You give me the phenomenological form of S of Na, I will give you the field equation. Now, for the standard class of field equations, I know what this S is, and it has the correct interpretation. And the main point where, as I said, I differ from many other people who do this sort of thing is that I don't think it should be very closely tied to Einstein's theory. There is a very deep connection between gravity and thermodynamics, which goes well beyond Einstein's theory. And it is, in some sense, related to the holographic structure of all these action functionals, which in turn comes from just general covariance and principle. Thank you.
thing works for zero temperature black holes?
No. It falls on its face for extremal black holes. Because I don't have a Rindler approximation close to it for us. So, completely fails. So, the only way where string theory succeeds, but this completely fails. So, I have no clue.
But still, you can conceive of systems which have a large ground state.
I tried that, but it doesn't work nicely. Yeah.
So this is going to sound like a similar question. Starts off, does this work? Does your argument work for general relativity in 2 plus 1 dimensions?
Sorry? Does it work for
Can you formulate general relativity?
Yeah, yesterday somebody asked me. Yeah, I think Florian asked me this. You can, but it becomes highly trivial.
Well, it's highly trivial, but what I was going to say is that if it does work, because there are horizons in 2 plus 1 dimensions.
Yeah, I know. It does work to that extent, but it doesn't give me any greater insight, because I have been following what Steve Carlip and people have been doing, and I was trying to see, once you have a full theory, can I get some insight into it, and none of that works. At least, I couldn't make it work, but we can discuss whether you have some new lines of attack on that.
Well, no, I was going to suggest the following. If it, to whatever extent it does work, since there are no local gravitational degrees of freedom in that context, it means that your degrees of freedom, which are heating up, which are
that is what is happening. I mean, the degrees of freedom sort of become backwards at the just when it becomes interesting. I can tell you mathematically how that happens. So it didn't help me much.
But does that suggest that in the real world, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, the microscopic degrees of freedom are not the closely related to the two polarization states of the graviton?
Yeah, I would buy that. I don't think the two polarization state of the graviton goes any deeper than the phonons of a solid. Okay? You quantize metric and you quantize the density field. You quantize density field, you get phonons in a solid. You quantize metric, you get gravitons with two polarization. Phonons do not tell you the atomic structure of matter. Gravitons do not tell you the atomic structure of spectrum. Yeah. I would buy that.
Okay.
Yeah, there are two hands, and maybe ladies first.
Okay. So I just want to try to understand if I want to apply these ideas in cosmological context.
Yes.
But few things that come to my mind that I...
This idea has been applied very, very wrongly in cosmological context by many people.
Right.
Okay, so I won't comment on that.
Okay. But
the problem about applying it correctly in cosmological context. I mean, I had one very short paper where I said that it works because of fortuitous reasons. Okay.
For example, can I get tensor modes in inflation just using thermodynamics?
No, not honestly. Okay. Because I'll tell you what it is all about. The preferred classes of observers in static spacetime are observers who are sitting at x equals y equals z equals, I mean, x equals constant, y equals constant, z equals constant. Those observers are accelerated in a static spacetime, like a short wave spacetime, etc. If you take the corresponding thing in Friedman-Robertson-Walker, they are not accelerated. Their acceleration temperature is zero. There is no Andrew effect for them. They are geodesic observers. So what you have to do is to cheat and say that I'm going to take the geodesic separation vector in Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe and take the acceleration of that. That will give you A double dot upon A. And you attribute a temperature to that, then everything else works. If you do that one step, everything else works. I have never been able to convince myself why we should do this in the case of a cosmology. Okay? So, most of the papers which has been written are very, they say, oh well, this is the obvious thing. A double dot is like an acceleration, and then goes on with attributing this temperature to it and works it out. But that is very different from what is happening in static spacetime. So I am looking for a natural generalization to time-dependent space-time. We have some ideas on that, but I don't have anything very specific to suggest. There is something from Rafael and then Lee.
Yeah, actually, I have two questions. The one I asked before, but I wanted to ask a more general question now.
You were there at Cape Town when I gave almost similar talk.
Okay, good point. Maybe I asked the same question.
Yeah, okay.
And this is actually not specifically tied to your talk, but it's tied to the idea that the thermodynamic interpretation goes well beyond, particularly Einstein. There's always something I've wondered about that. Maybe you know some work on it, which is that all the most of the claims in that direction deal, and the work in that direction deals with equilibrium situations.
Yes.
So the stationary black hole mm-hmm. and the first law in equilibrium.
Right.
But the most important aspect of the of entropy is in some way its increase.
Okay.
And in the case of Einstein gravity, there's a beautiful classical limit of that, which is the area law for horizons.
Right.
Are you aware of that? If it really goes beyond that, there ought to be some analog of the law of area increase. Maybe not some analog, but there ought to be some more general discussion of why, what it means for entropy to increase in non-stationary situations.
But there is some amount of work on GSL, I mean generalized second law, in Lovelock models, even in the non-stationary context, but none of them are definitive. See, there is something which I thought somebody will ask, but since nobody asked, let me ask the question, which is to do with, is this entropy positive definite? Is the entropy positive definite? After all, you better have entropies which are positive definite. Now, one peculiar feature about Wald entropy, which has nothing to do with me, Wald entropy is that it need not be positive definite. I can write down models for the theory where for a certain range of parameters it may be negative. But of course, then you can say that at that range of parameters, something else may be going wrong and that has to be excluded, etc., etc. So that issue is unsettled. But when I went and made a song and dance about my model gives you Wald entropy, I'm probably sort of laying myself open for this problem, that this entropy may or may not be positive definite. So if the entropy is not even positive definite, if I'm going to come up with some kind of a prescription for GSL, I don't know what it means. Okay, so the issue is still wide open.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the particular point I'm making is in the H star going to zero limit,
okay, you should
get gravity, you can more or less derive
absolutely.
That the area has
right.
to increase, and then you
right.
check,
right.
and you can.
Yeah.
And there's no similar cross check
in the other case.
In more general.
I agree. There was somebody else who had a hand up. Yeah.
So
let's get back to some point.
So if I try to follow your program or what your program points to, which I certainly have, to me the hard point is to get your first set of assumptions. Your first set of assumptions are there is some theory of microscopic degrees of freedom, okay, which already satisfies the equivalence principle and already somehow has special relativity in it because you
yes,
use
which leads to a theory which satisfies in the coarse grain sense some
right
like
right
that.
Right
yeah.
but there, it seems to me there are two tough challenges about that. One of them is very hard to think about a description of the physical world in which there's the equivalence principle but there's not almost all the rest of general relativity and the second is that if you really think that our description of the world is emergent, you might say, well, maybe special relativity and equivalence principle are emergent too. But in various condensed matter physicists and quantum gravity people have tried to set up systems where special relativity is emergent, some of them in this room. Okay? And it's very hard to get special relativity to be emergent. It's possible to get to get energy-momentum relations where energy is proportional to momentum, for example, but the constant of proportionality tends to be different for different degrees of freedom. So it seems very hard to even get started.
I have a slightly different take on both these.
Okay.
Okay. The first one is that I don't think it is difficult to get theories in which principle of equivalence and diffeomorphism invariance is maintained, but it is different from Einstein's theory. I think of Einstein's theory is half of the matter to be the field equations. Now, I can write down all kinds of action functionals in which principle of equivalence and diffeomorphism invariance is.
Yeah, but then you're at the classical level. Then you're not doing both these things, studying the microscopic.
We don't even know the quantum level of R root minus G gravity. I mean, we are still trying. So I'm perfectly happy making a classical statement. So remember, that is why I interrupted you and said that what I need is a microscopic structure such that when I take the appropriate classical limit, principle of equivalence and general covariance emerges.
Right. So what do you have in mind that would do that?
In that limit, I can get F of R gravity.
Which gravity?
Some function of capital R, F of R gravity, or a Lovelock gravity, any of these. They all satisfy this criterion. Because you were saying that it is very difficult to imagine a theory which has principal equivalence and general covariance, but at low energies, differs from Einstein gravity.
But no, I didn't mean in the sense that you're discussing the field of variance. I mean in the sense of the world is a differentiable manifold which is which feels on it where we want a different
okay. variance. So I meant it only in the field equation sense. Okay, fine. Now let us get back to the second question, whether the things like special relativity should be emergent or whether Lorentz invariance has to be emergent. Of course, in condensed matter systems, if you take this system, it has very nice smooth translational invariance here, but we know that it is built out of lattice of atoms which breaks that translational invariance. So in principle, there is nothing which prevents symmetries being broken at microscopic levels, which in the coarse grain limits gets picked up. But I agree with you that when people have tried it, they have all failed, or at least they have not succeeded as much as they should have in constructing such theories. So my personal belief, it's just a belief, is that these symmetries are going to survive even at the minutest scales, and it is not going to be an emergent phenomenon. And in fact, I wouldn't like to use this word emergent phenomenon. It has a fairly bad press by now. So various people mean various things by that term.
Mm-hmm.
All that I mean is, if you give me the microscopic theory of lattice and I get elasticity out of it, elasticity is an emergent phenomenon. That is the strict sense in which I would use. In that sense, I don't worry about whether Lorentz invariance is an emergent phenomenon or not. My feeling is it will not be, and it will be intact right the way down too.
Good. Okay.
Any other questions, comments?
Maybe we should put the emergent stuff, but let me ask you one that has a short answer.
Yeah.
But does this mean to you that there will not be gravitons? Or
there will be gravitons just like there are phonons. To me, gravitons are analog of phonons in condensed matter system. You have a smooth description in terms of density, you quantize that density vibrations, and you get phonons. Or magnons.
There's a question whether at a high temperature something like a phonon is irrelevant.
Okay, that is a separate issue. So I'm not saying there are no gravitons. I mean, gravitons will exist, but whether they are the fundamental.
So then we get by quantizing the effective.
Yeah, exactly. Description, right. Yeah.
Anything else?
Okay, then let's stop here and thank you.